Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. A massive moment. Law enforcement steps back and peace prevails as huge crowds gather nationwide to protest police use of force and systemic racism. Then, what's next? Is it defunding the police? A growing call to reallocate resources. We examine the practical realities, proposals to instead invest in communities. Plus, essential work despite the risks of the coronavirus pandemic and a funding shortage, the Postal Service continues to carry out its critical duties.
We pray that, you know, we're covered through the day and that we can be at work and work safely and return home to our families safely.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The nation echoes again tonight with protests over police using excessive force against Black Americans. And there are mounting calls for wholesale changes in policing. All of this comes amid final farewells for the man whose death galvanized a movement. White House correspondent Yamiche Alcindor begins our coverage.
Lines of people snaked around Houston's Fountain of Praise Church as family, friends, and strangers pay their final respects to George Floyd.
His death, it changed the world. It sparked this world, this change. And no matter what, things have to change and things have to be different.
Separately, the presumptive Democratic presidential nominee, Joe Biden, and his wife Jill met privately with Floyd's family. Meanwhile, in Minneapolis, Derek Chauvin, the now fired police officer who pinned Floyd to the ground with a knee on his neck, had his first court appearance. He faced an upgraded charge of second-degree murder. Bail was set at $1 million. Floyd's death 2 weeks ago has sparked nationwide and now global protests against police brutality and systemic racism. In the U.S., massive peaceful protests continue across the country, from small towns and suburbs to thousands in large cities like Los Angeles, where an estimated 20,000 people came out on Sunday. L.A. prosecutors today announced they will not charge thousands of protesters who've been arrested for curfew and other violations. And in Washington on Sunday, Republican Senator Mitt Romney of Utah marched with protesters near the White House. Today in Washington,
the world is witnessing the birth of a new movement in our country.
Congressional Democrats introduced a sweeping set of policing reforms in response to Floyd's death and protesters' demands. The Justice in Policing Act bans chokeholds, develops a national standard for use of force, limits the transfer of military weapons to police departments, defines lynching as a federal hate crime, establishes a national police misconduct registry, and limits qualified immunity, which protects officers from lawsuits over alleged misconduct.
We help
Congressman Hakeem Jeffries of New York is among those leading the push.
And all we've ever wanted is to be treated equally. Not better, not worse, equally. Why has that been so difficult to achieve? That's all we've ever wanted.
Today, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi urged the Republican-controlled Senate to consider the bill. For his part, President Trump has not put forward a plan to address policing and systemic racism. Today, he led a roundtable with law enforcement officials. He and his campaign have attacked Democrats, including Vice President Biden, for wanting to, quote, defund the police.
There won't be defunding. There won't be dismantling of our police. And there's not going to be any disbanding of our police. Our police have been letting us live in peace.
Today, Biden's campaign pushed back and said he, quote, does not believe the police should be defunded. In Minneapolis, 9 of the 13 city council members have called for dismantling the police department and replacing it with a new public safety system. Other proposals, backed by progressive activists and a few elected officials, do not call for police departments to be fully abolished. Instead, they push state and local governments to decrease police budgets while increasing spending on things like education and housing.
Now outside the White House, people have gathered to protest for yet another day. They've been doing this for more than a week. They tell me that they're going to continue to peacefully gather here until America confronts in a meaningful way the devastating and often deadly impact of racism. Judy.
In the day's other news, New York City began a gradual reopening for up to 400,000 workers after months of pandemic restrictions. At its peak in April, COVID-19 killed more than 500 people a day in New York. The number now is in the single digits. Meanwhile, in Geneva, Switzerland, the World Health Organization warned that globally, the pandemic is still getting worse.
I know many of us would like this to be over, and I know many situations are seeing positive signs, but it is far from over. And we need to shore up our activities. We need to build up the activities in the infrastructure that is not in place in many countries and continues to not be in place in many countries.
India, meanwhile, began reopening malls, hotels, and places of worship, despite reporting nearly 10,000 new cases of COVID-19. But New Zealand announced that it has eradicated the virus. Wall Street extended its rally into a fourth week today on optimism that the worst of the pandemic recession is over. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 461 points to close at 27,572. The Nasdaq rose 110 points and the S&P 500 added 38. In Paris, work began today to clear 200 tons of melted scaffolding atop Notre Dame Cathedral. It had been installed for renovations before last year's disastrous fire. Crews were lowered into the wreckage today. They will work through the summer and dismantle 40,000 pieces of charred, twisted metal. And a tropical storm that came ashore Sunday along the U.S. Gulf Coast has weakened to a depression, dumping rain as it goes. Flooding paralyzed parts of Mandeville, Louisiana today. Communities near New Orleans were also inundated, along with a region around Pass Christian, Mississippi. Still to come on the NewsHour, defunding police, a major effort to reallocate funding to invest in communities. We discuss the massive protests and potential reforms with Senator Cory Booker. Despite the risks of COVID-19, the Postal Service and delivery workers continue to carry out critical duties and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
As we've seen in Minneapolis, there is a shift underway in some places when it comes to reforming police practices. Namely, some are arguing that reform itself does not work. That's behind the idea of defunding the police. It includes a range of views that can mean shifting money and budgets to other social service agencies that might be better equipped to handle issues assigned to the police. In some cases, people are calling for outright abolition of police departments. We're going to spend some time looking at what these changes could mean. Charlene Carruthers is an organizer with Movement for Black Lives. She's the author of Unapologetic, a black, queer, and feminist mandate for radical movements. And Chuck Wexler is the executive director of the Police Executive Research Forum. It's an organization of law enforcement officials. And welcome both of you to the NewsHour. Thank you for being here. Charlene Carruthers, to you first. What is it that you would like to see happen to police departments across this country? How should they operate, in your view?
So fundamentally, the problem that people are rising up about the country or across the country right now is the issue of how much our police departments are invested in and how much our communities are not invested in. So what I would like to see happen in a city like Chicago, where I currently live, is that our over $1.7 billion budget, which amounts to just under $5 million a day, be greatly reallocated and invested in our communities, in our public education, in our healthcare, in quality public housing, jobs, and our environment. And frankly, that's not happening. What we're seeing happening with police departments is surveillance, violence, and the death of our people. And that simply must change. And we know that Band-Aid reform solutions aren't enough.
So to clarify, what would the role of police be? And you would leave some money for police working on crime that's committed, right?
Well, I understand that the process to living in a society where safety exists beyond policing will take a very, it'll take time. It won't happen overnight. So what I would like to see our local governments and also local police departments commit to a process in which we move essential safety services from the power and control of police departments into our communities. That means crisis response, and that also means with what how we deal with violence, conflict, and harm. It means that actually, eventually, the police are not the people who intervene or show up in instances of crisis, conflict, harm, or violence, but in fact, it's a community-based response that's outside of systems of policing, prisons, and jails.
Chuck Wexler, what about this concept of shifting these kinds of responsibilities, at least initially, for issues that around situations around mental health counseling, drug counseling, mediation, that money be shifted to other social service agencies?
Well, actually, I agree with a lot of what Ms. Carruthers said in terms of this is a joint responsibility with the community, mental health, homeless, dealing with the opioid issue. This can't be done by the police alone. We need the community. And I agree with her about investments in those institutions. We need to get kids to have jobs. We need to be working in community policing. We need to be doing problem solving. So there's not really much I disagree with Ms. Carruthers, except for the fact that at the very moment that we have a spotlight on the police, that's the time to take a hard look at how they do their job. Look, we need the police. We need humane police. We need smart police. So I don't disagree with what Ms. Carruthers said about the need to help, you know, prevent crime. We need community people. I've worked in Chicago. I know the crisis people that work, and they prevent gang violence. There are people in Chicago. They're gang interrupters that prevent violence. We need them. But here's where we are today. We had a huge incident in Minneapolis. It's a defining moment for this country. So we have some choices. Do we walk away from the police, or do we say, hey, you know what? We tried to change the police, but this was an eye-opener. What happened in Minneapolis was a total police failure. But there's some good cops out there. And when you're in crisis, you need a good cop. We can't just walk away from policing. Now is the time to get into policing, to do problem solving, to work with the community, to be better at what we do.
Charlene Carruthers, in your view, I mean, is this a choice between reforming policing further? We know some reforms have clearly already been instituted. Is it a choice between reforming policing and just doing away with policing, or how do you see it?
So actually, Mr. Wexler and I have fundamental disagreements. I actually do not believe that we agree about the role of the police. I do not believe that we should have a partnership between community and the police in order to deal with conflict, harm, and violence in our communities. What that power, those decisions, and that role, including the money, needs to actually be completely shifted, and not simply into social service agencies, because we also know and understand that many social service agencies act in proxy to the police department across the country. And what we're seeing in Minneapolis is not simply a case of a few bad apples. In reality, we know that the entire tree is rotten. It's been rotten since policing was even developed in this country. We know its origins in serving as slave catchers for enslaved Africans. We know how police played a role, a major role in Jim Crow. We know how police continue to play a role in the mass incarceration of Black and brown people. What we're talking about here is a big vision. We're talking about radically shifting and transforming the world that we live in. We know that defunding the police is one step, but one essential step, because power, how it works in this world, is through organized resources, meaning money, and organized people. And so we're going towards the source of what we know the government understands, corporations understand, and police unions understand, is that we're coming to say we want power shifted into our communities.
And in essence, Chuck Wexler, what I hear Ms. Carruthers saying is that police as an institution, you know, doesn't work anymore.
Well, you know, maybe if I was in her shoes, I might feel the same way. I don't take away anything she said. She's lived this. I haven't. But here's what I know. At the end of the day, there's 18,000 police departments in this country. 90% of our 25 officers or less. We have no national standards, no guidelines on use of force. We put out guidelines on use of force 6 years ago. And we believe in the sanctity of human life. We believe in the duty to intervene, rendering first aid. We need humane police. We do not have a plan B. If you said in Minneapolis today, we're going to disband the police, what does that mean? Someone needs to respond to someone when they're in crisis. Someone, if you need a police officer and you're in crisis, there is absolutely nothing better than a good cop and absolutely nothing worse than a bad cop. We need police in society, but we need humane police. We need good police. We need to be working with groups like yours in Chicago. We cannot do this alone. We cannot change police. We need the community with us. This was a defining moment in Minneapolis, but let's use this moment to change an institution. You know, society needs police. We need humane police. We're better than what happened in Minneapolis.
Ms. Carruthers, what about his point that as a country, as a society, we need police in crisis situations?
So I live on the south side of Chicago, and every single day my community is surveilled by the Chicago Police Department. We put literally well over $1 billion into the Chicago Police Department every single day. At the same time, we see story after story of violence that is happening in our communities. The police are not keeping us safe. Any semblance of safety that we have comes from within our community. We know things like good jobs, good education, good health care, mental health crisis actually reduces violence that happens in our communities. And to Mr. Wexler's point, about who do we want to respond in crisis, imagine that you are being assaulted by your partner, or you are in the middle of a mental health crisis. And instead of a person showing up with a gun and a taser and an entire police department behind them, it's a social service worker. It's a mental health crisis worker. It is a sexual assault crisis responder. We in Chicago, our Chicago public schools have more cops than they have counselors. What I'm saying here is something that some neighborhoods and communities already know. We know wealthy communities and white communities know what it's like to actually have resources instead of having more cops. And that's what we're talking about here. It's not a vision that's unattainable. It's a vision that actually invites more community into the process.
Chuck Wexler, final word. Is that something that's workable?
Oh, I think that is workable. I think teaming up mental health workers with the police could be absolutely workable. We don't feel like we have a monopoly on mental health issues, on drug issues, on people in crisis. But here's the reality. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. Are those other social service agencies willing to step up? If they are, come join us. We need all the help we can get.
Well, we certainly hear you both. It's a conversation ongoing for some time to come. Chuck Wexler, Charlene Carruthers, we thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
While defund the police has become a rallying cry for Black Lives Matter activists and some of the thousands of protesters across the country, Democrats in Congress are considering their own set of proposals. Amna Nawaz has more on that.
That's right, Judy. And just today, the New Jersey State Attorney General released video of the fatal shooting of an unarmed Black man, Maurice Gordon, by a white state trooper last month. It happened just 2 days before the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. In Congress, more than 200 House and Senate Democrats have now signed on to the Justice in Policing Act. As we laid out earlier in the program, it would, among other things, ban chokeholds, end no-knock warrants in drug cases, mandate police training on racial bias, and collect data at the federal level on the use of force. One of the bill's sponsors is Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey, and he joins me now. Senator Booker, welcome back to the NewsHour. Let's talk about this legislation now, because there are some elements in here that have been on the table before. Efforts to stop militarization of police, to end racial profiling. Neither of those bills came to a vote under pressure from police unions and others. So what's different about the proposals now, other than the moment in which they're being brought forward?
Well, I think, first of all, the moment is the message that we have today. There's been no great bills of social change in this country, from workers' rights to civil rights, LGBTQ rights. It hasn't had large-scale efforts, mass mobilizations of nonviolent protesters. There's an old saying in Washington, change doesn't come from Washington, it comes to Washington. And so when you have hundreds of thousands, if not millions of Americans, engaging in forms of nonviolent protest in all 50 states, multiracial, multigenerational, multireligious coalitions, this bill that would never have gotten this many co-sponsors just a month ago now has two-thirds or more of the Democrats in the Senate and has 100-plus, closing in, I think, of 200 House members. So this bill has a lot more momentum to it, and you're right. And that's almost the ridiculous reality, is that many of these common sense ideas in this bill have been around for decades of people demanding for those change to happen. Well, now the demands are growing louder and all around this country, and some of these practices that should have been banned decades ago, I believe we now have a chance of getting it done.
You mentioned the co-sponsors. It's worth pointing out you don't have a single Republican co-sponsor out of those many that you listed right there. Why not? You pride yourself on reaching across the aisle, working with your Republican colleagues. What are they telling you is their hesitation in signing on to this?
Well, I'm not going to put any spotlight on anybody right now that I'm in good faith negotiations with, but I'm talking to Republican colleagues across the aisle. It's a long process. It took me years to get many of my Republican colleagues who were earlier on in my Senate career were talking against criminal justice reform, but ultimately we partnered on a bill that liberated thousands of people from prison, something people told me was impossible to get done. And so, again, this is what's right, and this bill is on the right side of history. And I know that this is the beginning. This is the less than 24 hours since we've presented this bill, but now we go to work. And the great thing, again, is that the community at large is demanding these changes beyond partisanship. You see people just saying this is the right, that we don't have no-knock warrants where plainclothes officers barge into people's houses, guns drawn. That's a recipe for a disaster, like we saw with Breonna Taylor. We've already seen a few dozen police departments ban the kind of choke holds that killed Erica Garner. These are very common sense things that a police officer does egregious wrong shouldn't have immunity in federal courts, virtual immunity. So these are things that the average American would say are common sense to enable us to hold people accountable. And will stop things like Tamir Rice being shot and killed by a police officer who was on the verge of being fired from another police department and just ducked out of that one and ducked into another one because we have no national databases of misconduct. These are common sense reforms that will protect people's lives. And it's the right side of history, and we're going to keep fighting until we get them done.
Senator Booker, I want to ask you about the other conversation around the police right now, and that is this defund the police movement and conversation. You have said that you won't use the phrase, but that you understand the substance. So what does that mean? Do you believe that police departments today constitute too much of a line item budget, big a line item budget in many city and local governments?
Well, first of all, I'm watching Donald Trump try to weaponize this slogan like he did try to weaponize Black Lives Matter or the Green New Deal. That's not a conversation that we need right now. What we need is to talk to the real issues going on in our nation, that we are the land of the free, 5% of the globe's population, but one out of every four incarcerated people on the planet Earth are here in America. One out of every three incarcerated women are here in the United States of America. If you go into our prisons and see who we treat with police and prisons and jails, it's the most vulnerable in our society who need help. We overwhelmingly incarcerate people with mental illness. That's not a policing problem. That's a healthcare problem. We overwhelmingly incarcerate those who are addicted to drugs over and over again, and costing us millions of dollars before they get treatment. That's not a police problem. That's a societal problem and a medical care problem. We now criminalize poverty in this country and have for years. Ask anybody who has warrants out for their arrest because they couldn't afford the hundreds of dollars worth of traffic violation tickets that they have. So clearly we are a society that is investing in things that cost taxpayers much more money, that are an affront to human dignity, that don't elevate human potential and don't reflect our common values. So I'm not going to get in a false political argument when what I want to get into is how do we create a more beloved community in our nation when we care for those people who are hurt and in pain and struggling and help them to avoid the need for police in the first place. If we were making investments.
So, Senator Booker, I'm sorry to cut you off. I know that your time is limited. I hear you saying that you think those funds should be reallocated to meet some of those problems on the front end. But I want to ask you about this. This is an issue for mayors. This is an issue that you have had to make before in Newark. Back in 2010, when you were facing a budget crunch, you made the decision to cut about 150 police officers out of that budget crunch. And back then you said, when I first came in, we were starving other city departments to push more resources into the police department. Other mayors today could make the same argument. Was that a mistake back then?
No, I think it's because you're dealing with this as if it's a zero-sum game. The reality is what we started doing in the end of my term as mayor is experimenting with bringing in the John Jay College School of Criminology to see if we could attack some of the problems, drug crimes, drug violence, not with police intervention, but with community intervention. And we saw tremendous success on that. This is not a zero-sum game, pulling a dollar from one place, putting it in the other. It's about deconflicting our society. It's about stopping this over-reliance on police, prisons, and jails, and finding solutions, evidence-based solutions that work. And if we keep constructing it in a way where it's a zero-sum game, we're going to start lining up people on both sides. If we talk in a larger way, that there is a way to keep our society much safer with a less use of taxpayer dollars, and in fact, a better investment. And I can give you case after case as a guy who studied cities for the greater part of my 20s and 30s, I can show you cities and communities that have made these decisions strategically and shown that they could save taxpayer dollars, stop crime more than any police can, and elevate human potential. And that's what we should be having a constructive conversation about.
Senator Booker, before I let you go, Vice President Biden has not yet picked has not yet picked someone to run alongside him. Given race relations are a more urgent priority for America right now, does he need to pick a black woman?
I'm not going to tell the nominee from our party, who I trust with being the President of the United States, I'm not going to tell him who he has to pick. I trust that Joe Biden will pick someone who's prepared to be President of the United States, pick someone who can help to heal our country and bring us together, and someone who's qualified for that job. I know he has a lot on his mind and a lot to weigh. This is the most important election of our lifetime, and I trust that he will make not just the right decision in this case, but as President of the United States, he'll make many of the right decisions to help our country heal, come together, and envision and establish a more beloved nation.
That's Senator Cory Booker, Democrat from the state of New Jersey, joining us tonight. Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you.
In the midst of this pandemic, millions of people are relying on mail carriers and delivery workers for essential supplies. The Postal Service, meanwhile, is struggling financially, seeking help from Congress and under fire from the president, who says he won't back financial relief unless the Postal Service raises rates. Amna is back with a report based on talks with postal and delivery workers on the front lines every day about the risks they face and the challenge of staying safe.
Every morning in Louisville, Mississippi, LaTanya Outlaw and the mail clerks she supervises at this post office gather in a circle outside and 6 feet apart.
Effective immediately.
It's their daily safety protocol meeting. Standard during the pandemic.
Avoid ringing the doorbell when possible.
LaTanya has added another team ritual.
We pray that, you know, we're covered through the day and that we can be at work and work safely and return home to our families safely.
LaTanya and her team are some of the 630,000 U.S. Postal Service workers sorting and delivering mail to millions of Americans every day. But that is not without risk. More than 2,500 Postal Service employees have tested positive for the virus, and according to the American Postal Workers Union, more than 60 have died. They aren't the only ones on the front lines. They join workers from companies like FedEx and UPS, who are among the essential workers keeping people connected, delivering packages from shuttered businesses, groceries to families sheltering in place, and prescriptions straight to patients' doorsteps.
UPS calls me a service provider, but I'm a truck driver. I deliver packages for a living.
Steve O'Connell has been with UPS 15 years and says he's never been busier.
I gotta go work.
10 to 12 hour days are his new normal.
I'll have nightmares of the amount of packages that are in the truck on a daily basis that you really have to stop and take a deep breath when you see it.
and he knows the risk he faces each shift. He's seen it up close at the Boston UPS facility where he works.
It was just weekly. One to two to three guys would go out, and one would come back, another one would go out. You would ask, where is this guy? Oh, he's out on COVID.
According to O'Connell's union, Teamsters Local 25, five employees at that UPS facility tested positive for COVID-19, and another five were presumptive positives. UPS told the NewsHour that they do not disclose positive cases to the media and said in a statement that they are vigilantly taking steps to protect the health and welfare of employees, customers, and the general public. But back in March, O'Connell worries he carried the virus home from work. His wife, Hannah, was diagnosed by her doctor with COVID-19 despite testing negative. Just 33 years old, she was hit hard.
Watching her trying to walk from the couch to the bathroom and then come back in tears because she can't breathe. And with the two-year-old running around, and he doesn't understand what's wrong with his mom, and it was difficult.
Should we put some banana in it?
Today, Hannah is slowly recovering, and after 2 weeks of self-quarantining, O'Connell is now back at work. Wearing this Boston Strong mask for protection in a place he says social distancing is near impossible.
Every truck is right next to each other. Everyone's crammed in a hallway together trying to get, you know, the board in the morning. And there are guys who have kids with brain tumors, wives who's got over breast cancer, and they're scared to death. They don't want to bring the virus home.
As a shopper for Shipt, Target's delivery service, Willie Solis is an essential worker right now, but the job is essential for him too.
I honestly open up my bank account to see how much money's there and figure out if it's something that I have to go out and venture out into the world to kind of expose myself to make money. Today's one of those days.
Solis, who is immunocompromised, has his own rituals to stay safe before entering a store. He repeats his rules to reduce his anxiety.
Remember social distancing? Remember to give yourself some space, 6 feet apart.
After he leaves each store, an exhaustive decontamination, disinfectant spray on his clothes and even his hat, then immediately washing his clothes and showering once back in his home. It's stressful, he says, but he can't afford to stop working.
If it wasn't for the limited amount of times that I'm out there, I wouldn't have any money to put in gas in my car or food on the tables.
The work of these essential workers can seem thankless. Their customers are hidden behind closed doors. The less contact, the safer they all stay. But more and more during this pandemic, some customers are finding ways to connect and show their gratitude to the workers they've come to rely on.
In Sioux Falls, South Dakota, 11-year-old Emerson Weber, an avid and prolific letter writer, decided to write one to her own mail carrier, Doug.
Why did you decide to write him a letter? I knew he saw a lot of letters, but he may not receive a lot, so I just wanted to put it in there to brighten his day during work.
Hi, how are you?
Doug shared the letter with his boss, who shared it with more colleagues, who shared it with more. Next thing she knew, Emerson was getting letters from postal workers across the entire country.
There were people writing and saying things like, I work alone in a small rural post office. People writing and saying, my kids all live far away. Did you expect that total strangers would open up like that?
I certainly didn't.
Her father, Hugh Weber.
We sat as a family and just read them all aloud. And it was also this moment of recognizing how much we needed that kind of echo back.
New connections made, even as old ones are tested. Go. At the end of every day for LaTanya Outlaw, another ritual before she can greet her two young children.
I always try to keep that distance before I actually go and get myself ready for the end of the day.
Is that odd for you to not walk in the door and immediately be able to hug your kids?
You know, it's hurtful to a certain degree, but I know we have to maintain that distance just for a short period of time until I can get myself in a position where I feel safe enough to give them hugs and kisses. And it is just still such a blessing to be safe and well.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Amna Nawaz.
The sheer magnitude of protests in the streets have raised public health questions as well. If people are not social distancing and they're gathering in the thousands, even tens of thousands, are they exposing themselves to a greater risk of COVID? And how should that risk be weighed against public health concerns over the lives and living conditions of African Americans? Lisa Desjardins explores some of that now.
Judy, those questions are part of what protesters, physicians, and public health officials have been weighing as people mobilize. In fact, nearly 1,300 public health professionals signed a letter supporting the protests, arguing that systemic racism is a health problem, that it has contributed or led to a disproportionate number of deaths among African Americans. More than 20,000 African Americans have died from COVID already. The numbers are incomplete, but indicate that blacks, who make up 13% of the population in the U.S., account for 24% of the deaths from COVID-19. Dr. Georges Benjamin is executive director of the American Public Health Association. Dr. Benjamin, I want to start right away with how we balance these two things. These protests are happening about a public health crisis, African Americans being killed or harmed by police. But they're also happening in a public health crisis, the coronavirus. How do you weigh those two things?
You know, it's a difficult decision, but people have to make a risk-based decision, recognizing that there is a risk of going out. They may get infected. But the challenge is that particularly African Americans are fearful each and every day. And that's a risk that we have to take. Now, I tell folks that if you're going to go out, then you need to protect yourself. You need to wear a mask. You need to carry hand sanitizer. You need to try to physically distance as much as you can, but understand that you are carrying a risk when you go out in public like that.
I want to ask some more specifics about that for people going out. Should they be doing things like shouting, for example? And how do they keep from kind of getting into other people's space, even when they're in a small space? Also, how about the authorities? What should they be doing to try and minimize the COVID exposure for themselves and for the people there? We've seen a lot of reports about how the use of tear gas may be a health problem because of this. Can you talk to both of those groups?
So absolutely. So to those individuals that are out there, again, just trying to stay as physically separate as you can, recognizing that, you're gonna talk, you're gonna shout. The more you do that, the more likely you put yourself at risk, but keeping your mask on as much as you can. And for the police, tear gassing is a problem. You should use that under very, very strict guidance. It causes inflammation of the lungs. It causes people to cough. They'll take off their masks. This kettling, putting people in a little box, which brings them all together, is a problem. And of course, the plastic bullets, those rubber bullets that they talk about that being non-lethal, are also very, very, very dangerous. But this is a global phenomenon, and we see that people are very concerned. And as a nation, this is a phenomenon, and people are making a risk-based decision that they much rather be out there letting people know that Black Lives Matter versus and taking that risk each and every day versus the risk that they take simply walking down the street being Black.
I want to come back to that big picture in a second, but one more specific question about how this works. We're learning a little bit more about how the virus spreads. Do you have a sense of the best and worst case of what may happen in these crowd situations from the virus spread right now?
Anybody can tell you that they can really model it. They can't really tell you. But we do know that it will increase. We'll get people that will be sicker. The good news is the vast majority of folks that get this disease have a mild case, but the concern is for that 15 to 20% that have a very severe case. And just to point out that anyone with a chronic disease, diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, lung disease, you're at greater risk. And we also know that communities of color, particularly African Americans, are even more at risk because they disproportionately have those diseases.
So you are the executive director of the American Public Health Association. I have to ask you, looking in a much bigger way, which is our privilege to do here on NewsHour, where would you place the role of race? This is a big question in American health. What kind of effect does it have in our system?
Race tragically is the original sin which causes health inequities. And we need to change things so that we value all people equally. And if we don't do that, we're not going to really be prosperous as a society. Race matters.
You know, some people are looking at these protests and saying, wait a minute, most states still are not allowing large gatherings. You know, even as we phase in some reopening, people aren't supposed to be meeting in groups of 25 or 50, but they are allowing these protests. You support these protests. Can you tell us why?
You know, I believe that everyone has to make a risk-based decision in life. I would prefer that George didn't get killed. I would prefer that we didn't have police brutality. I'm a strong supporter of sound policing, but when things get out of control, as they have in our society, then we have to speak out, we have to do something. And the American Public Health Association has been a strong proponent of human rights. And you know, we would not be who we were if we did not believe in this social judgment movement that we're seeing. It is a risk, but at the end of the day, if we don't take this risk right now, when are we going to do it?
Dr. Georges Benjamin of the American Public Health Association, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
It has been a momentous 2 weeks in American life with the potential to transform political discourse, policy, and the 2020 presidential campaign, which is now officially down to President Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden. Biden quietly crossed the delegate threshold to clinch the Democratic nomination on Friday night. Our Politics Monday team is back to take on where things go from here. That's Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report and host of Public Radio's Politics with Amy Walter, and Tamara Keith of NPR. She also co-hosts the NPR Politics Podcast. It's so good to see both of you, especially after this tumultuous days that we've been through. Let's talk first about the pressure that Democratic members of Congress, Tam, must be feeling right now. We heard a little bit earlier in the show from Senator Cory Booker, but what do all these protests and calls for police reform, what does that add up to if you're a Democrat in the House or the Senate?
It adds up to they are working on legislation and pushing ideas forward. I mean, certainly they do feel some pressure from the protest to get out there and stand for something, but also they're out there trying to create a contrast with President Trump and his administration, which has not really talked much about police brutality in a systemic way. The president has been very focused on the case of George Floyd, but he hasn't been willing to broaden it out. He has talked about bad apples being involved in Floyd's case, but not willing to sort of talk about police reform more seriously. He nodded to it a tiny bit at an event today, but Democrats are out there saying that they want to stand for something on this.
And Amy, you have protesters, as we heard earlier in the program, people saying we need to get rid of police departments. We don't just need to add on more reforms, which they say haven't made any difference. We need to do something drastic. If you're an elected official, what do you do with that?
Well, we know what one person did. The person who is the Democratic nominee for President, Joe Biden, came out with a statement today saying that he wants to see police reforms, but the idea of defunding the police is not something that he supports. And look, I think when we're talking about the contrast right now between where Joe Biden is and where Donald Trump is, the onus really is on President Trump right now. Overwhelming majorities think that the president has not handled these protests very well. Majorities believe that the protests themselves are valid. More people than ever, we talked about this last week, Judy, especially white voters, believe that there is systemic problems within policing, that Black folks are identified more likely than whites to police violence. And so the sort of shift of balance right now, the pressure is really on Donald Trump right now to change where this race is, the race between Joe Biden and himself, and also where the conversation is. And right now we've seen a number of polls come out in these last week where The president is down against Joe Biden anywhere from 7 to 14 points.
So, Tam, is the thinking, whether it's from these polls or other evidence, that what we're seeing in the streets of America is having an effect on Trump voters as well as Democrats, who are presumably many of them energized by all this, to vote against President Trump? But what about the people who voted for him the last time? Are they hearing this?
The people who voted for President Trump last time are hearing the message that President Trump is delivering now. And that message is a law and order message. He said he's the president of law and order, and he's been pushing this idea that the protests are violent, or he's really highlighted, keyed in on the aspects of the protests that have turned violent, or the looting. It's really familiar territory for him. He did the same thing back in 2016. And the difference this time, though, is, as Amy said, public opinion has moved a lot. And I was talking to Democratic pollster Cornell Belcher, who both looks at that polling, but is also just looking at who's out there protesting. And he says, when you have suburban white kids out there protesting, then this law and order theme that Republican candidates, including President Trump, going back to Richard Nixon, have used, it doesn't have the same resonance in the suburbs if the suburban kids are marching in those protests.
And that's my question, Amy. Is this actually cutting into to voters who chose Donald Trump the last time?
I don't know that it's necessarily cutting into Trump voters. I mean, he still has incredible well of support among Republicans. He's still getting 90 plus something percent of their vote. But even when you ask the question in that NPR Marist PBS NewsHour poll about whether these protests were valid, whether they thought that Donald Trump was handling it well, a third of Republicans thought the protests were valid. A third of Republicans thought that President Trump wasn't handling it very well. But they are still supporting the president in the reelection. The challenge for this president has long been that he keeps going back to these same issues, the same strategies over and over again, which tend to bring his voters in, but do not bring anybody else along for the ride. And that is what you're seeing right now, is he's losing independents by bigger margins. He's always lost Democrats. And the bigger concern, I think, going into the fall for the president is that this suddenly doesn't work to even energize his base enough, right? It's always about priming and pumping his voters out. At some point, does this start to lose that energy that he's counting on, which is why we're hearing today that he is intending to start his rallies again, probably in the next couple of weeks.
Which will be interesting to watch given social distancing. But just quickly, Tam, to the extent Joe Biden needs an energized, excited, motivated group of voters to turn out, if his position is not where some of the Black Lives Matter activists are in terms of defunding the police, you're saying you don't think that's a problem for him?
You know, I think there is a real range in viewpoints among the people protesting and marching and what they're calling for. And Biden is, you know, has taken this position that he doesn't support defund the police. I think the concept of defund the police is a lot more nuanced than the words would let on. And certainly nuance doesn't always work in politics. But Biden is certainly trying to figure out where he stands on this, how to say it. He does have a justice plan on his website. But the Trump campaign is certainly trying to affiliate him and tie him to the defund idea. And being able to run against that for Trump is easier than having to talk about what he's going to do to address the concerns of the protesters.
Well, we're hearing it all now. It's just the 1st of June, but we're forecasting all the way to November, which is what I ask both of you to do every single week, and we'll continue to do. Tamara Keith and Amy Walter, thank you both.
You're welcome.
Welcome.
It has been almost 6 years since the fatal shooting of Michael Brown by a police officer in Ferguson, Missouri, sparked national protests. Tonight, we revisit our brief but spectacular interview featuring filmmaker Damon Davis. His documentary, Whose Streets, followed the unrest in Ferguson and explored the experience of Black Americans.
There are things that you must think about to survive daily being Black in America. The neighborhoods you're in, the clothes you got on, the way you talk to people. Being Black is a weapon. You understand? The weight that you carry and the darker your skin is so terrifying that like you're just walking on eggshells your whole life. And the level of anxiety that comes along with that, I don't know any Black person that doesn't know what I'm talking about. I've been harassed by police. I've been pulled out of cars, sat on curbs, humiliated. There's a huge chunk of the population that this is everyday life for. And think about how privileged you must be to not be afraid every day you walk out of your house. To not be worried about, I'm driving and one of my taillights is out, or I'm driving in the wrong neighborhood. This tally list that you have to go through being Black in America. I hope people that are finding out about this, that actually care, try to use that privilege that they got to do something to make it a little more even for everybody else. Over the last few years, the trajectory of my life has changed monumentally. And the events of Ferguson and Mike Brown changed my entire life, I can honestly say.
We are willing to go down on your watch. But treat us like humans and not like animals. Don't beat us like dogs when you do arrest us.
I ain't let none of you. Whose Streets is a call and response chant that was used out in the streets in St. Louis and in Ferguson. Also asking whose streets is it? If the police working for the people and your rights are to assemble, says the Constitution, whose streets actually are they? In the trajectory of American history, I don't think things have changed much from 3 years ago or 30 years ago, 300 years ago. We've been talking for about 200-300 years. It's time to take some responsibility, some culpability, and really get uncomfortable. Think about the everyday role people play in racism, whether it be locker room jokes, Thanksgiving dinner jokes, down to systematic and systemic racism and the jobs and roles that people play in it. You know, when they talk about being an alcoholic, the first step to recovery is acknowledging you have a problem. Well, America has a pretty big problem with doing that, you know? It's like, why don't y'all just get over it? You know, it's like, but you had like a 280-year head start. It's kind of hard to get over it when people run around the track and then they shoot the gun for you to start. I think until we start talking about that, the conversation is a waste of time. You know what I mean? I think it's patronizing at this point. It really is, yeah. My name is Damon Davis, and this is my brief but spectacular take on courage.
And we thank you, Damon Davis. And tonight on the PBS NewsHour Online, the latest episode of our podcast, America Interrupted. We hear from protesters in Minneapolis and Washington, D.C. about why they are out on the streets and what makes this moment feel different. You can listen on our website. That's pbs.org/newshour/podcasts. Or you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening for all of us at the PBS NewsHour. Thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.